See Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 409. Sunday, October 3rd, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, hey, everybody. Sorry it has been so long between episodes. The first thing up in this episode is the conclusion of my conversation with Rob T. Rob and I talk about nutrition, fitness, well-being in general, and also culture, because, well, the culture's gone crazy and it's kind of hard not to talk about it. In the second part of the program, I've got a conversation that I recorded yesterday with your ad attacker, Jim, of the Attack Ads podcast. And also Ed the Willing from Montreal, longtime friend of the Sea Realm, comes in at the end of the conversation. So I'll have some stuff to say at the very end, but for now, here's the conclusion of my conversation with Rob T.
So it's called Primal Endurance by Mark Sisson. And Mark Sisson established the health coaching school that I'm working through. So circling back to kind of what framework I'm using.
So what's Mark's last name?
Sisson, S-I-S-S-O-N. Mark's Daily Apple. He's one of the kind of original members of the paleo movement. He's been very influential in that. And yeah, he's another guy I've heard about for a long time, but only kind of really started diving into his work recently. So he was a champion endurance athlete. World-class endurance athlete. But he says when he was competing, he was really, really unhealthy on the inside. Like his fundamental health was pretty low. And so he's been on a journey of figuring out how to have a much stronger foundation of health. And what one thing that he really advocates is kind of long duration, low intensity cardio. And so there's a threshold where you go from burning primarily fat to burning more sugar. So at a certain intensity level, you can't burn the fat fast enough to fuel the activity that you're doing. And that that type of exercise is more intense and it takes more time to recover from. But you can stay in that low intensity aerobic, fat burning mode of exercise for a long time. You could spend hours a day doing that if you keep your heart rate below a certain level. And so you can get extremely efficient at burning fat that way.
So what's an activity that would put me in the right target heart rate range?
So jogging, and not trying to jog too fast. And for me, my fitness honestly isn't that high, but what fit people can shoot for is a 10-minute mile. So a 10-minute mile is not all that intense. Mm-hmm. And you can do that for hours if you're fit, without breathing heavy, without really breaking much of a sweat. So that's an example, swimming, cycling. If you can fit a stationary cycle, a bicycle in your apartment, that might be a really good fit for you. And I guess just dipping into the science for a second, what you're doing is you're strengthening your mitochondria, which fuel the, the fat-based metabolism. So you can actually multiply the number of mitochondria in your cells and just really strengthen the cellular machinery that burns fat. Because your body has already become so efficient at burning fat, you have a really, really good foundation and you don't have the sugar dependency that most people have.
But there's a class of men hearing this who are of the never do cardio school, never get on a treadmill, never do any cardio, just, intense, short duration, either high intensity training or weightlifting, and particularly if you're over 40, never do cardio. Where do you think people with that position are coming from? And what's your position on it?
Yeah, there's definitely a place for that. The thing is, you don't need to do much of that. If you sprint like one time a week, you're probably going to spend the rest of the week recovering from that. That is extremely beneficial. That triggers a lot of the hormonal, like a hormonal cascade. That's extremely beneficial to you to do that high intensity workout. But unless you're a top tier athlete, you're unlikely to be able to do much of that and get the full benefit of it. So for that high intensity activity, what you really need to emphasize is rest and recovery. So when you do that, you need to make sure you've recovered from it before you do it again. And so that's the benefit of the low intensity cardio is you can do a lot of it and there's not much recovery time needed because you're not doing something that your body needs to recover from.
Yeah, well, you probably know I'm a big devotee of weightlifting and my gym went out of business last December. So I haven't done it in over half a year and I miss it. Oh, do I miss it? And the thing that I miss the most is deadlifts, you know, not the sexy bench press or, you know, bicep curls or anything like that. It's just the full body exertion. You know, and it's not isolating any particular muscles. It's really, it's a full body exercise and, you know, doing that two or three times a week, you know, to loud music, that was a key component in my mental health regimen. And I miss it for sure.
That's great. Great stuff. That's something I haven't done a lot of. I want to work up to that. I do more body weight exercise. And I've been learning, you know, kettlebells, clubbells, mace. So more, not big heavy weights, but, weights that, can be really, really effective. And the fitness modalities that I've studied really emphasize, balancing out the strength work with mobility mm-hmm. and recovery. So a lot of the biggest gains I've got from doing that work hasn't actually been, you know, strength and endurance. It's been learning how to move my body correctly again. You know, having spent, you know, decades not using my body correctly, it's been a long journey. You know, just our culture is very desk bound, you know, chair bound, and so. I think it was 7 years ago when I came across something called TACFIT, and I started trying to do this body weight fitness routine, and I realized I couldn't even come close to doing any of the movements. I could not squat. I could not come anywhere close to doing a flat footed squat to the ground. And this was a body weight fitness program that was based around using your body in a holistic way. And using your full range of motion and I'm trying to think of the word for it, but you know, the movements that you do in yoga, those are movements that use your whole body in an intelligent way. And you can add weight to those and you can do them in a high intensity type of regimen, like a high intensity interval training type of program. And so TACFIT, circular strength training is the other kind of the more general term that TACFIT came from. And so it's using your whole body in a holistic way in functional movements, and then cycling through, you know, the strength and endurance back to the recovery. So they call it decompensating. So when you do something high intensity, like the deadlift, your body is adapting to that. And it's actually going to cheat a little bit. It's going to like harden your fascia in ways that makes it easier to do that next time. But what that's also doing is limiting your mobility. And so that's going to make other activities harder. And it's also going to eventually lead to, you know, restrictions and possibly injury because you're not going to have access to your full range of motion. So when you do the high intensity work, high strength work, you need something like a yoga routine, or some sort of targeted, flexibility routine to basically work that hardening of your fascia out of your system. And then mobility, always returning back to kind of a basic mobility practice to ensure that you have your full range of motion, which is important to actually do the more high intensity stuff correctly with good form.
You know, in my last decade of life, I've either done yoga or weightlifting, but rarely both at the same time. But, you know, when the practices were overlapping, I thought, wow, these are really complementary practices, and one's, you know, you can't get the full benefit of one without the other. But you know, that realization or that thought hasn't been enough to get me to go to the gym and the yoga studio. You know, it's usually one or the other.
Yeah. It's a lot, and you're a busy guy.
I'm not a busy guy. I waste so much time, particularly since COVID. I just sit here in my apartment. Like, you know, I used to go to the gym at midday, and that was, you know, I'd work in the morning, go to the gym, come back, eat, and then do a second, you know, stint of work. And now I'm just here all the time. You'd think, well, if you're not spending time at the gym, you have more time for work. And I do a lot less work now. It's like, you know, that time at the gym, actually seeing other human beings, doing something that's not mental, was really valuable for my mental work. And I'm the poorer, you know, for the loss of it.
This pandemic has been crazy. I have to say, it's actually, on the whole, it's been a positive for me. So we purchased this property in January of 2020. We were more or less fully moved in February. So I was commuting down to Sacramento. So I drive down to the Amtrak in Auburn, which is about a half hour, and then ride the train and then have a little hike to get to my office. So it's a fairly lengthy commute. I was actually enjoying it. You know, the train was fun. I felt like a kid kind of riding the train every day, but it definitely took me away from my family and what we're trying to do here on this property. And so in March, so the following month, you know, pandemic is in full swing. So for the last year and a half, I've been living and working pretty much full time on my property. And I definitely feel the social isolation. There were months where I just didn't really feel comfortable leaving the house, leaving the property. So yeah, I mean, all the social dynamics and you know, the larger kind of cultural context has been a real challenge. But just being immersed in you know, the 6 acres that we have, the animals that we have, spending this time with my family, you know, watching my daughters develop. My youngest daughter was one when we moved here, so she's about 2.5 now, and my oldest daughter from about 3.5 to 5. So being able to be present, much more present for them, and actually, you know, experience that firsthand rather than, you know, being in an office a long ways away and kind of catching them for periods here and there. It's really been amazing for me. I feel extremely lucky just how things worked out. And yeah, we didn't plan it. I didn't know the pandemic was happening and get my new property in anticipation. It just worked out that way.
So I'm looking at Google Maps right now. I just looked up Grass Valley, and just getting a sense for, you know, where in California you are. California as a whole state is definitely a blue state, but Northern California, if it were its own state, would be a red state. And I wonder, I can't really tell, you know, given your location, you're not so far north that you're up into, you know, the now sort of no longer the logging country, which used to provide a lot of jobs and now provides far fewer jobs. And so, you know, let me ask you, what's the cultural sort of background, you know, the background noise of where you live?
It's probably similar to where you live and where I grew up. I grew up on the north coast of California, in Mendocino County. Okay. which was an interesting blend of kind of logger culture and hippie culture. And I think it's similar here. There's a lot of progressive elements here, you know, vibrant kind of artistic and spiritual communities. I think yoga, there's a lot of yoga practitioners out here. Like there is that, but then I think the larger backdrop is far more conservative. I think once you, even in California, once you get out of the urban areas, it's a pretty conservative place. So yeah, I think it's a interesting mix here. This is where Gary Snyder lives. So there's kind of like a beat connection, kind of countercultural element out here. But yeah, I think the general, you know, the average person you come across is probably going to be more conservative than not.
So I don't recognize the name Gary Snyder. Who is that?
He was the subject of Jack Kerouac's book, The Dharma Bums.
Oh, okay.
He was part of that beat movement. He's a poet, and he's also a hardcore Zen practitioner.
Gotcha. So do you see MAGA hats around?
There is a fuck Biden sign between Colfax and here that I've driven by, drive by regularly. I haven't seen MAGA hats actually. As I said, I haven't actually spent that much time out and about. I've definitely been more of a recluse.
Well, yeah, I live in Vermont, as you know, and there's a big, very progressive, very demonstratively, you know, socially signaling sort of progressivism here. But there's also a lot of poverty, and poor white people tend to be conservative. And then there's a lot of people, you know, who are, they've lived here a long time, and they don't live here in town. They live out in the county, and they're very rural. But, you know, because they're in Vermont, they know to keep their cultural conservative notions to themselves, because it could be a very, you know, big disadvantage to you here to be outed as a Trump supporter, you know, either in your job or just in your social relations. It can really bite you in the ass. You know, so there's not only a lot of cultural animosity that sort of simmers below the surface between the people with money and those without, and there's also, I think, a lot of sort of secret whispering going on of, you know, people who, you know, they have opinions that they know they cannot express openly, you know, the sort of things that would get you banned from Twitter or Facebook. But then there's also just a lot of poor people who tend to be really apolitical, who never talk about politics, don't care about politics, don't know anybody who cares about politics. And they walk past on the sidewalk. Well, you know, probably the progressives are driving by in their cars if they're not exercising. But, you know, they're passing by people every day who are intensely political and who spend all day on Twitter and Facebook, you know, and who have yard signs to demonstrate their progressive bona fides. It's my crossover between the two worlds was the local justice center, where the people running the center are intensely political and the clients that they serve are intensely non-political. Like, you know, maybe they know who the president is, but they don't care and they don't have any preference as to who the next one should be. It's an odd sort of nexus. And the mask thing, I know it's worse in other places. But, you know, I've reported the times where I'm outdoors, the sun is shining, there's a wind blowing, and I'm about to pass somebody on the sidewalk. I'm not wearing a mask. They are. And they make an ostentatious show of stopping and stepping off the sidewalk into traffic to protect themselves from, you know, my irresponsible breathing as I walk by outdoors on a windy day. It's, you know, I'm not making any effort to be fair here, you know, in describing this behavior. I find it absolutely reprehensible. And, you know, I can, from what I know of human psychology and neurology, I know that these people are just getting super high off of that indignation, you know, and off that public display of condemnation for me showing my face. I can't pretend to be neutral on the topic.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think, like you, I feel excluded from both tribes. I certainly am much closer to the blue tribe than the red tribe. Though there are certain things that I'm more naturally aligned with the red tribe. It is generally conservative congressional representatives who will stand up for something like raw milk like our right to drink milk that hasn't been processed.
Right.
So it's a really unsatisfactory kind of marketplace. I think politics is because I think you mentioned recently, it's just a random, feels like a random conglomeration of issues on each side. And it's kind of bound together by this tribal loyalty where, when you look at the collection of, ideas for each platform, they don't go together, except that there are a tribe of people that have agreed that, you know, this is what we believe in.
Right. And it's a coalition of tribes.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Although the red tribe is much better about, you know, if you share one of our beliefs, then you're a part of our tribe. You don't have to share them all. Whereas the blue tribe tends to be a lot more purity obsessed. You know, if you have one bad opinion, one bad take, you're canceled. You're done. You know, you either need to grovel in abject humiliation, in which case you might still be canceled, but, you know, we'll let you grovel, or, you know, you're just done. And I know that's a stereotype, but, you know, I see it played out so regularly that it's a very vivid and substantial stereotype. And, you know, for any stereotype, no matter how ugly and mean-spirited, there is somebody who embodies it, you know, deliberately and aggressively.
Yeah. And it's, you know, when Trump, during the kind of the Trump era, there was a lot of, I think, conflict between people who, you know, in real life, they're friends or colleagues, but people are just getting so polarized along these fault lines. And I see the same thing happening with, you know, the pandemic. It definitely feels like what you're describing with the blue tribe, just having the expectation of purity and loyalty. I think there's better ways to say it than that, but really you need to not only fall in line with these ideas, but you should be, you know, signaling that, you know, you're part of our tribe as well. And
right. Like, yeah. You yeah. It's kind of who holds an unviable opinion and you didn't denounce him. You know, what are you doing?
And yeah, it's become kind of a frenzy. I mean, I don't think it's a good thing. And I wonder how long it can hold up. So I saw somebody on a friend of ours on social media getting lambasted for posting a wear a mask meme. And what the person was saying was, okay, you're the same person that told us, you know, 2 weeks to flatten the curve at the very beginning of the pandemic. And every couple of weeks there's been a new message, and you've been wrong every single time. If you want to wear a mask, wear a mask. If you want to wear three masks, wear three masks. But don't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And so I think there's definitely a loss of credibility. But yeah, the psychology of the blue tribe is not, at this point, is not such that they can admit that and have an honest conversation. And so yeah, there's. I don't know. I hope it turns out for the best, but yeah, I can feel the tension boiling and kind of the underground kind of simmering of resentment that you're describing. And it's logical to me that if you're told that your viewpoint is unacceptable for public discourse, you know, that there's not really anywhere to go from there, right? Except resentment and resistance. I don't know. For me, I've largely tuned out a lot of the larger kind of cultural stuff that's happening because it just doesn't feel helpful to me, and I don't feel helpful to it. There's not much I can really offer it, so it just doesn't feel like a good use of time. But I still have a desire to have kind of deep, meaningful, topical conversations with people. So if the RTEC group could provides a venue for that, I think that would be exciting to me.
Anyway, we've been on for a good long time, so this is probably a good time to wrap it up, but let me offer you the last word, and I would encourage you to address it to your fellow Sea Realm Vault subscribers.
I think I'll address it to you, Kamo.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, yeah, it's been kind of a long journey on this podcast, and I've really valued the perspective that you provided through the podcast. And I'm just feeling a lot of appreciation for that. And I've really enjoyed spending a little time with you today. Getting to know you personally, it's really been a pleasure for me.
Well, likewise. I've said this many times, but you know, I can correspond with somebody via text for years and have just a vague notion of who they are. Talk to them for an hour, you know, hear their voice, see their face, and they're a fully fleshed out human presence. Whereas before they were just sort of a vague indication of a presence. So I'm happy to close that circle.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, I'm sure that it's a little one-sided. We get to see a lot more of you than you see of us.
It's the parasocial relationship. Yeah. All right. Well, Rob T, hey, it was good hearing from you. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
All righty. That was Rob T. And I did go and watch a video of somebody who uses goats as pack animals for like backcountry hunting expeditions. And it's captivating. It's an amazing human animal relationship. And he kind of disses dogs and horses, not Rob T, but the narrator and subject of the video I'm talking about. And, you know, humans have longstanding partnerships with both dogs and horses, and it's not the fault of dogs or horses that modern industrial living doesn't really need dogs or horses or really humans for the most part. Goats are also largely irrelevant, so I'm glad that, some folks have found a place for them in their lives. All right. Now, here's the conversation, the first part of a conversation anyway, with Jim, your ad attacker. And I just want to remind you, because it's kind of a shock. I mean, I know it's coming, and in the editing, it still came across as a shock. While Jim and I are talking, Ed is also on the line, and Ed's going to come in right at the end. But this is largely a follow-up to my last conversation with Jim, where we were talking about the book The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class by Joel Kotkin. And in it, I played a clip of Hillary Clinton speaking in India, talking about how, well, we're going to start off with Jim just reading that quote from Hillary Clinton. So we'll start with that.
So I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward. I won the places that represent 2/3 of America's gross domestic product.
So from here, Jim is working on a podcast where he's going to be talking, I guess, about NPR. He hasn't shared a whole lot of detail with me about his intention, but he said it was a big project and he'd ask me to record another pass on my basic criticisms of NPR and how they have changed over the last 5 years. So we'll pick up with that.
Okay, so NPR, and I'm a lifelong NPR, not only listener, but financial supporter of my local NPR station. For me to make this change is quite the sea change. It used to be that NPR would present a lot of data, a lot of facts, quotations, you know, information, and then allow the listener some latitude in drawing conclusions, and they no longer do. Even in their briefest, most encapsulated, you know, mentions of any particular story, they have to tell you immediately what your position on it is. And there is nothing left, you know, to the judgment of the listener. So, for example, at the start of Trump's presidency, you know, if they wanted to suggest that he was lying, they would make reference to a claim by President Trump, which other sources contest, they might say, something like that. By the end of his presidency, they would just say, so-and-so responding to Trump's lies, and then, you know, they'd make their statement. Or, you know, there's this virus, unspecified virus of unknown origin. You know, when certain people were pointing out that this virus supposedly originated in Wuhan, China, where there was also a virology lab where the United States was funding gain of function research, NPR would phrase it as Trump referenced the debunked conspiracy theory that the virus escaped from a lab in China. I mean, they would just tell you in bringing up the whole concept, they would tell you, if you're an NPR listener, if you're a loyal Blue Triber, this is a conspiracy theory. We're gonna frame it. We're gonna, you know, pronounce that it is a conspiracy theory as soon as we mention the topic. And if you disagree with that, you're canceled, buddy. You are unacceptable. You are out of bounds, off the page, no longer in your lane. You are not allowed to make that supposition. We're telling you what's open for interpretation and what isn't. And the idea that this virus is anything other than, you know, as Jon Stewart says, a bat fell in love with a pangolin or a pangolin, you know, then you're alt-right, MAGA, crazy, deplorable.
That's the one. Yep. Yeah. This came up when I was on the drive home the other day. I've been thinking about this for a while, but I've been noticing that it's more than just NPR. It's now Wikipedia.
Oh, it's, yeah. It's been Wikipedia for a long time. In fact, it was Wikipedia before it was NPR.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And the amount of, we must correct the record lest this misinformation fly fast and furious, has gotten extreme. And people are just freaking out at the amount of stuff that they don't agree with that is accepted as agreeable.
Yeah. NPR is in a weird position in that Joan Kroc, widow of McDonald's founder Ray Kroc, many years ago now, dropped more money on them than they ever knew, could know what to do with, more than they could ever spend, really, doing what they do. And so for about a decade, it has been an absolute lie when NPR is doing their fundraisers and they say, we can't do this without you. It's like, yeah, you can. You don't need the federal government. You don't need any money from anybody forever, really. You've got so much money now. I mean, you can just invest that in very conservative investments and run your operations off the interest. You guys are set.
Wow.
And I don't know if that has anything to do with their shift, but they have to understand. Maybe they don't. Okay, this is where I'm uncertain. From my perspective, they have to understand that people like me who have appreciated, you know, their pitch to the long attention span do not appreciate this, you know, radical constriction of what we're allowed to think, you know, what we're allowed to consider.
But it's all things considered.
Right. But if they don't need my money anymore, and they haven't for a while, then, you know, maybe to them it is more important. And even if we're just in the, if we're just in the realm of money, they get a shit ton of money from Google. They get a shit ton of money from Amazon. They would probably much rather stay in the good graces of those companies, you know, who are ruled by woke ideology than, you know, get my occasional $20. So even on a, you know, dollars and cents basis, it might make perfect sense for them to do what they're doing.
Well, and then we have to consider the role of the enhanced sponsorship, which is the reason I, a lifelong NPR listener in the same boat you were, pretty much bailed out in 2005.
Oh, wow.
From regular listening, because in 2003, Bush W. put in charge of productions a guy named Kent Tomlinson. And it was part of a way to balance the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And when they say balance, of course, they mean bring it from the left to the right.
Yeah.
And back then, they've always had the sponsorship notices from the big corporations and the big philanthropic organizations that were endowed by the capitalists from days gone by, the Fords and the Carnegies. After the enhanced sponsorship was adjusted, they had actual ads for actual products.
Oh, yeah.
And that just, of course, me, Jim, your ad attacker, I couldn't take it. I just had to stop listening to the daily production. Yes, they limit it to 2 minutes every hour. Good. All right, good on you. You don't have 15 to 20 minutes every hour, but, you know, still. We are living in a world with too much of that stuff, and it doesn't need to happen. It was only brought in, not as a revenue, net revenue generating move, but as a way to discipline their outlook, in my opinion. I mean, they very quickly got new shows like Business Week or Marketplace, as opposed to the old shows that they had that actually looked at communities that could not thrive getting their message across in the commercial realm. The stuff that was absolutely out of the question to be considered in commercial media could and was designed to be explored under public back when it was founded in 1968. And it just never happened. Then it slowly disintegrated into our what we have today.
Yeah.
I do think that the current trend that you pointed out is separate from the money. I don't think the money has much to do with it. I think their brains broke.
Yeah.
They were so appalled about what had happened that they began a apoplectic floundering for causation. And because they are in the Hillary Clinton camp, because they are in the credentialed classes camp, the only thing they could think of was maybe it was misinformation, which is why people focused on Russia as hard as they did after Trump was elected. Oh my God, we're being manipulated by Russia. Well, what about the $1 billion that was spent on the campaign by Americans? Never addressed.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how much the Internet Research Agency spent, but it was certainly not $1 billion.
So that was 2016. Flash forward to 2020. And I think this was the moral reasoning. You know, maybe it wasn't explicitly articulated, but I think this is what was going on in the background. Donald Trump is Hitler. Somehow, by some miracle, we have escaped concentration camps in his first term, but there's no way we will in the second term. You know, if we're not all annihilated in a nuclear war, then we'll all be, you know, shivering in the cold with lice by the end of his second term. It does. I mean, there's nothing worse than that. It doesn't matter. There's no crime we can commit. There's no sin that we can commit, which will be the equal to letting Donald Trump become president a second time. So it doesn't matter. I mean, we can say anything. And in fact, we must say whatever it is we think we need to say in order to make sure he's not reelected.
That sounds right. And by the way, that future scenario, the lice are actually kept as pets. That's how bad things have gotten. Yes. Their brains broke when he was elected against all expectations, because, of course, they were focused only on the very limited possibilities that a credentialed class can even consider.
Yeah.
And the fact is they haven't yet gone into the Trump-loving places where you have the diseases of despair, the heroin overdoses, the drunkenness, the suicides, the despair that people are experiencing. They've gone in and talked about poverty. They've gone in and talked about how people can't get jobs. But they haven't connected that to the rising populism, where the people without the jobs are saying, all these people with college degrees are trying to run my life.
Yeah.
And since they all have college degrees, they wouldn't understand it if they were told that.
Because I've listened to NPR for decades, you know, voluntarily, I can easily put myself into the headspace, I think I can, of somebody who to this day approves of NPR's behavior. And I think what they'll say is that, you know, most Trump supporters are doing fine financially. They're just bigots. You know, they're just proto-Nazis. They're doing fine. And there's an element of truth to that, not that they're proto-Nazis, but that they're doing fine. Because as I've learned firsthand in my work with the Justice Center, people who are struggling, you know, just to get through the day, they don't care about politics. Mm. They don't know who the vice president is. They certainly don't know who the Speaker of the House is or who the Secretary of State is. And they don't care. They don't want to know. Not of interest to them. Mm. The people who do know that stuff are the ones, you know, who have jobs and houses and cars and families and healthcare. But, you know, they culturally, they're not of the of college set. Mm-hmm. They may have gone to college, but, you know, they probably went to college and took, you know, courses that they thought would help them get a good job and didn't really lean too hard into the humanities. And so they didn't really pick up the culture of college. And I'm cribbing from Thaddeus Russell here.
Okay.
This is largely his message. You know, he's the one who uses the phrase of college. You know, that's the major cultural divide in this country right now, are people who are of college and those who are not. And, you know, some of those who are not went to college, as I say, but they went there to get credentialed for a job, not to absorb the, you know, the Blue Tribe culture. And there are people who absorb the Blue Tribe culture and who basically have educated themselves online in wokeness who haven't been to college. But they have the vocabulary and the thought patterns of people who have, you know, particularly if they're on Twitter. You know, because Twitter has that limited word count, you really have to use shorthand. And the shorthand is provided, you know, the shorthand is not only provided, it's dictated. These are the terms you will speak in when you're discussing, you know, these topics. And if you deviate from this short list of accepted talking points, well, you've just outed yourself as a deplorable.
Right. Because or you have
as a lazy
characters.
Woke person, you know, the woke person who hasn't kept up with the changes in the talking points and who's saying things which would have been acceptable to, you know, the extreme Blue Tribe 6 months ago. But, you know, if you're using the talking points of 6 months ago, you're suspect. You're not really making an effort to keep abreast of what you're supposed to believe.
Well, what you said earlier before the Twitter thing just sparked something. I think there's another demographic, the people who are not of college, the people who went to college but found they were not of college.
Right.
As you say, with Thaddeus Russell. Mm-hmm. And the reason that, you know, maybe they were there, as you say, for, you know, credential for a job, or maybe they were there because it was just expected of them. But when they got there, they heard things that just offended them culturally and just left in disgust. And I can think of several people like that. You know, they didn't understand why they needed to take, which meant, and they took that class, and it meant nothing to them because they couldn't get their brains around why people would sit around to do nothing except read books and talk about them. And there's a great book, which is called, let me read her name. Oh, Arlie Russell Hochschild.
Oh yeah,
Strangers in Their Own Land. Yeah,
I've read parts of that book. I haven't. Okay. I didn't finish it, but I read at least the first third.
Good. Yeah, and one of the things she pointed out was that with the people that she got to know best, one of the driving factors in their lives is work.
Yeah.
You not only have to work, you have to work hard. It doesn't matter that you're working at something that's stupid, as long as you're working hard at doing something stupid, which just blew my mind because, you know, my life is the avoidance of stupid work. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I really don't. And she was talking with one person. I was just looking for the citation in my notes, but I'm not going to bother diving too deep. I can synopsize it. A woman who was doing some research, I believe, at the University of Madison, or University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she was going out into the rural areas and talking to people. And this woman was kind of offended, not just at the questions, but the fact they were being asked by somebody who didn't work. Was like, what do you mean? I work. I'm a college professor. It's like, that's not work. You're sitting around reading books and talking to people, and you're not doing anything productive.
Yeah, that's a sit-down job.
Yeah, that's white collar. That's not work at all. You got to be blue collar. You got to get your hands dirty. You got to, you know, take care of kids, flip burgers, plow roads, drive buses, things like that. And I think a lot of the rejection of the of college people is from that perspective. They just go there to these colleges and get jobs and somehow survive and do nothing but undermine. Not only do they not work, they undermine the culture of the people who are working and providing the food and building the houses and doing the useful things in life.
You know, backing up a little bit to you need to work hard and it doesn't matter if the work is stupid. You know, my father, who's been dead for over 20 years now, he was a big Rush Limbaugh fan back in the 90s, possibly before. And I remember having discussions with him where, to him, giving money to people who aren't working is the height of immorality. Mm-hmm. But paying two crews of people, one to dig a hole in the morning and the other to come and fill it in at night, and giving them money for that is fine. Yep. As long as they're working. And
they
it doesn't matter if they're just digging
yes.
holes to fill them up again.
Yep. I have encountered that more times than I can count.
Yeah.
I've just finished Henry Ford's book. I did a small podcast about it. He said on multiple occasions, you know, hiring two people to do the job that can be done by one should be a crime. Or somebody who works hard is worth something, and somebody who tries very hard to avoid work is worth nothing. And he said the same thing. You can't give people charity. That's just teaching them how to be dependent.
Yep. But paying them to dig holes and fill them up again, what's the purpose there? I
mean, well, it could be a way of aerating. I don't know.
Well, you know, when my dad said that, you know, he was explicitly saying work that has no, you know, value, no intrinsic value, no extrinsic value, no value really at all, other than right. It inculcates the habit of work.
Right. And the people standing on the side of the road with a sign that says anything helps, will not drink for food, you know, are bad. But the people holding the sign that says cheap mattresses just ahead, getting paid an ungodly small sum, they're good. They're both holding signs. They're both doing nothing other than holding a sign, which can be done. And I've tested this with something called a post. And it's the same dig the hole, fill it again mentality that says, hold the sign and I'll give you something, but I'll give you nothing unless you do something to show that you can work. It's ridiculous. It is. I have had so many arguments about that direct comparison, the beggar versus the mattress person, the mattress sign holder. I hate that. I
or think it's the tax filing business.
Tax filing, the gold buying, yes. Yeah.
May I please add an illustrative aside to this?
Please do.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, there's a program here. We have here in Quebec something we call pénurie de main d'œuvre. That means a lack of manual labor. There's a lot of help wanted signs. There's a lot of jobs going unfilled. There's a lot of potential tax revenue that is not being generated. So right now the government is very focused on getting the labor workforce activated. And in the field of information technology and communication, there's a particularly acute pénurie de main d'œuvre. And so they cast out the net for people like me, people with a technical background, work experience, education in IT. And they said, hey, we'll send you back to school to get up to date with your technical knowledge. We'll pay you to go back to school. We'll pay your tuition and we'll pay you a stipend. So that sounded like a good deal to me. And I applied for it and I had a phone interview with the, we call it Emploi Québec, the employment department of the government. And when the woman interviewed me, she asked for a detailed year by year breakdown of my work history. And when we came across areas, period in my work, in my history where I didn't work, she was like scandalized and shocked. She said, well, what did you do from 2009 to 2010? And I said, oh, I think I took a break there. And she was like, what? What do you mean? And I said, so then I could see from her reaction. So I had to quickly put a spin on it, you know, to say, oh, yeah. Da, 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 da. But that's one thing that I found, like, it was utterly unacceptable in her worldview that somebody just would choose not to work. And that is the illustrative aside.
Hey, Ed, while we've got you here, this call is going to end in 4 minutes just because we've got multiple participants on it and I don't give Zoom any money.
Yes.
But in these 4 minutes, given the topics that you've heard me and Jim talking about over the last few minutes, what do you think of NFT-based play-to-earn games? What would be like the social or moral implications of, say, a young man could stay home and play some play-to-earn game and make more money doing that than he could running a cash register at McDonald's?
Well, I think of our economies have been super productive ever since that we industrialized. I think Marcuse talked about this around the teens, that with factory production, in terms of the basic human needs, food, shelter, clothing, with factories, every single person has much more. So we live in a super productive society. So we have time for excess, for things that are not necessary, like entertainment, being numbed in a fantasy world, like the gaming world or the movie. That's why the TV production gaming industry is so big, because with all this abundance, we take great pleasure in these fantasy worlds. So in that sense, yeah, the people that are involved in the gaming industry at very different levels, they're adding value to society in that they're providing this very pleasant fantasy state of mind that people so enjoy getting into. And sometimes those states are actually salutary. There's aspects of them that are edifying in that they allow for mental experiences that can be enriching to the spirit, and they can allow for contact between ways for human beings who otherwise would not have any avenues for to contact each other, to interact with each other. So it's not entirely it's not entirely to be frowned upon as just mere escapist, mind-numbing entertainments.
All right, so the conversation with Jim continues. In fact, it continued yesterday, and I think we did at least another hour. So I'm going to get to editing that, and it is my intention and aspiration to have that not only edited, but commented upon and marked up as a podcast and uploaded and shared with you via the SeaRealm Vault RSS feed by the time I go to bed tonight. So on Ed's comments, Ed departed to go swimming at this point, and so from here on out, it's just Jim and I. It's just me and Jim. Jim and I, people from the South, and you don't hear it in my voice, but I'm from the South. They tend to say I when me is grammatically correct. Bill Clinton did this a lot. And it's because to the Southern ear, me sounds stupid and uneducated, and I sounds smart and sophisticated. But that's neither here nor there. The conversation that you just heard continues with just Jim and me in the next segment, which will be in the next episode of this podcast. It'll be episode number 410, which I hope to have out to you within the next few hours. But in the remaining moments of this podcast, and I'm not going to go on at length because I do have, a lot more podcasting work to do today, I just want to provide a bit more detail regarding my question to Ed. So, as you may or may not know, I'm guessing most of you probably don't know this. You've heard of cryptocurrencies. You probably have heard of NFTs, non-fungible tokens. Unless this is an area of interest to you, you're probably not following the transformation of the gaming industry in the wake of the development and, the popularization of the NFT. It's nothing new for computer games to have in-game currency. Gold pieces, credits, whatever. But you can't take that in-game currency to the grocery store and buy popcorn and ice cream with it. Not yet, anyway. That's changing. Cryptocurrencies and NFTs, non-fungible tokens in the form of deeds to virtual real estate in game worlds, or objects in game worlds, or character skins in game worlds, markets are developing for these. And also, games are being developed that use cryptocurrency as the in-game currency, cryptocurrencies which are exchangeable for dollars. And there are already games in existence where, depending on where in the world you live, it is more profitable to sit down at your computer and play this video game than it is to get up and leave your home and go to a place of employment and do work. As far as I know, it's still more profitable to go toil for minimum wage here in the U.S. than it is to play just about any, play-to-earn video game. But that's changing. And to some of you, that might sound perverse. To others, it might sound like a godsend. It's like, oh my God, I can sit home and do what I was going to do anyway, which is play video games, and get paid for it? To me, that is definitely a double-edged sword. And it's very much the same conflicting emotions that I have around universal basic income, which is paying people to stay home and do nothing, you know, or, you know, UBI advocates, of course, would say, no, it is recognizing that a lot of work goes unpaid and people only do it because they recognize that it is necessary and they do it at great cost to themselves because they don't get paid for it. Things like childcare, elder care. You know, I was walking home from the store yesterday and I passed an old lady who was walking her dog and I noticed she was bending over to pick up some poop, but she had the bag of poop she was holding was almost as big as her small dog. And she started complaining to me about the people here in Bellows Falls who don't pick up after their dogs. And there's, you know who they are, right? They're the poor people. They're the people who have subsidized housing. They're the people like me on Medicaid. They're the people who are addicted to drugs. You know, they're poor, slovenly, not sophisticated, not of college people. They litter. They don't pick up after their dogs. The ones who drive cars make deliberate efforts to make their cars louder. You hear me defend them from time to time, particularly against criticism from the of college people, but I certainly don't want them to have the power to make the world over in their image. For those folks, honestly, UBI or getting paid to play video games is probably a net positive. Their lives are chaos. They do the minimum to get by. They make no effort at self-improvement. Providing them with the means they need to, you know, have reliable food, shelter, clothing, and transportation, medical care, it's just a decent human thing to do, and you're not holding them back. They weren't going to do anything anyway. But there are people, and, you know, I can't speak in the abstract here. Of course, I'm thinking about my kids. I just think it would be the worst thing in the world for them developmentally if it would cost them money to put down the game controller and go to a job. I think it would be a bad outcome for them personally if they could make more money sitting home playing video games than going out and doing a job, even if it's an unpleasant, stupid job. Getting out into the world and interacting with people is important. And yeah, retirees who have pensions and Social Security, you know, and other forms of income and security, even in the absence of getting up and going to some toil every day, they developed that habit of getting out and doing things by working. And now that they don't need to work for the income, they still are in the habit of getting up and going out and interacting with people in the world. And getting, you know, paying young men to stay home and play video games, it's the natural evolution of our society, right? I mean, young men are not wanted. There's a TV show that I'm watching on HBO Max, which I watch it and then I stop it and I turn it off and I watch it some more and I turn it off because I can't bear it. It's so cringy. It's called The White Lotus. It takes place at this very expensive high-end, you know, spa resort in Hawaii, and all the patrons, all the customers, the guests are wealthy white people. And, you know, the people working there, some of whom are white, but, you know, they all need the money and they're not of the same social status as the guests. The guests are clearly their betters and the guests know it. The staff knows it. Everybody knows it. Everybody tries to smile and get, well, not everybody, the staff tries to smile and get along. Some of the guests are positively vindictive. Others are crazy and they're all contemptible. And they're all woke as hell. And as much as, you know, I cringe and I feel great empathy for the staff at this fictional resort, you know, having to deal with these entitled, self-satisfied, liberal as the day is long motherfuckers, I don't think they'd be any better off getting paid to stay home and play video games. And yet I'll talk to Jim about this in the conversation you'll hear in the next episode, this idea to pay people to play video games is not government policy. You can't vote against it. You can complain about it, but it's just, you know, it is technology interacting with human creativity and the market, and this is what we're getting right now. And I can't, you know, in good conscience, I can't complain about it because the game that is the furthest developed along these lines is a game called Axie Infinity. And their in-game currency, which is called the Axie, is also a cryptocurrency which you can buy on various cryptocurrency exchanges. And I own some. And it's increased in value by about 300% since I bought it like 6 weeks ago. So I don't play the game, but I've bought some of the in-game currency. And in the next podcast, I'm not sure how much of it, because I haven't re-listened to it. You know, the conversation just took place yesterday. I don't know how much of it is going to be listenable for somebody who can't see what Jim and I are both seeing, because during part of the conversation, I fire up Minecraft and I enter into a Minecraft world, which is, it's Minecraft isn't the game. Minecraft is just the engine that the game runs on, you know, like Unreal Engine. But the game is called The Uplift, and it is an NFT-based, what people call a metaverse. Although I think that term is still sort of reaching, and there is no metaverse yet. Not like you see in Snow Crash, you know, the Neal Stephenson novel. Or, you know, for people who don't read sci-fi but who see the occasional movie, Ready Player One. You know, the 3D graphical interface internet that everybody in that movie interacts with goggles and gloves, it's called the metaverse. And it's coming. You know, right now there's a lot of little metaverses taking shape, but part of the whole cryptocurrency project is to make all cryptocurrencies and all blockchains interoperable with one another. Which means, you know, the metaverses, the little metaverses, will be merging into a big metaverse. But during the conversation, we're talking about, you know, all the things that are of interest to us. And at the same time, I'm tooling around in The Uplift, which looks like Minecraft. And for most of this world, I can't interact with most objects. I can't, you know, I can't do all the Minecraft things of, you know, breaking blocks, placing blocks, building things, except on one little 50 by 50 square, which I own. My plot of land in this game is an NFT that I bought on a secondhand market, because as soon as any new game world opens up a land sale, you know, they say, okay, hey, we've got a new game coming. You know, to get in on it, you need to own a piece of land. The land's for sale. Immediately, speculators swoop in and they buy all of it. And then a normal person who wants to actually play the game has to go to some secondary market and buy a piece of land, you know, virtual land, from a speculator. I did that. You know, I spend time, not that much anymore, but still some time in The Uplift. And so Jim and I, you know, we're commenting on what he and I are both seeing. So stuff, you know, I'm going to go through it and I'm going to edit it today, and stuff that I think doesn't really make sense or isn't very interesting to somebody who can't see what's on screen, I'll cut that out. All right, that'll be in the next episode of the CRUM Vault podcast, episode number 410. I'm going to get to work on that in just a few minutes. So closing this one down, but I'll talk to you again quite soon. Stay well.